Entrepreneurs M&A Journal, episode number 48.
Welcome to Entrepreneurs M&A Journal with lawyer and Harvard MBA, Jim Cumbie, a weekly podcast dedicated to helping entrepreneurs make better decisions when selling, buying, or launching a business. And now, here's your host, Jim Cumbie.
Hello, friends. Welcome to this week's episode of Entrepreneurs M&A Journal. This is the podcast dedicated to buying or selling a business. My goal is to help business owners gain a competitive advantage and make smart decisions when going through the M&A cycle. Each week I interview a successful, been-there-done-that entrepreneur, and through their real-life story going through the M&A cycle, I hope you will be inspired and more confident along your M&A journey. This week I'm talking with David Finkel, who has started, bought, and sold a number of businesses. David is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Scale, which is 270 pages of great information based on his M&A experiences. The book's subtitle probably says it all: Proven Principles to Grow Your Business and Get Your Life Back. Let's start by learning a bit about how the book came together. Well, David, welcome to this week's episode. Now, before we dive into your M&A journey and your considerable experience, give us a brief background of your professional world. How did you make the jump from an operating business to a consulting business? What was sort of your thinking in making that transition?
Sure. Well, I mean, early on, even the first company that I built with a former business partner, Peter, the company ended up morphing into not just a training company, but it actually coached residential real estate investors. We would work with, you know, typically 1,500 to 2,000 a year in a formalized mentoring program, and trained probably another 35 to 40,000 per year at workshops or online classes or through the materials that we had. So it was a fairly natural jump. By the end, when I sold that company, it was 8 years after we started it, I found that for me, I had gotten really, really good in that world, but it was boring. You get kind of tired with it at that point. It wasn't very challenging. It was the same 7 or 8 real estate transactions coaching people on over and over again. So we just translated those skills as I figured, what did I want to do for the next business? And started off where the clients that we had, many of them had other companies. And so it was a natural shift over. A lot of these clients who wanted to learn about the real estate a couple decades ago had other businesses. And we had gotten so good about how to systematize the real estate investment company, we said, well, what if we were to start working with some of these other clients and their other companies about how they could systematize those businesses? And you know, trial and error for a couple of years until really probably I'd say 5 years ago, we really hit the mark on how to process out replicatably and scalably to coach a business owner to reliably grow their company and get their life back. That's how we made the shift.
So you've used the word scale. Scale is an important word in your vocabulary. Tell us about your book and the development that you went through to get it published.
So at this point, Scale was the 11th book that I've written, business book. And I was talking with a friend of mine. His name's Jeff Hoffman. And a lot of your reader or listeners here won't know Jeff by name, but they'll know the company of one of several that he started. So Jeff's like me. He's a serial entrepreneur. And one of his large successes was a tiny little travel company that got started that turned out to be Priceline.com. And so now market cap of, you know, $60+ billion with that. And so I was pushing Jeff. He was a guest speaker at some of our conferences. And I was pushing Jeff to write a book about his experiences because he'd have these wonderful ways of framing how he scaled Priceline and other businesses he'd done. And it fit in well with how we were teaching our clients. And he wasn't doing it. So finally I said, Jeff, I'm about to do another book right now. Would you like to do the book together? And we sat, talked, and realized that there really was a complementary approach that we both had on how do you take a business and scale it and do it in such a way that you don't just grow it. But here's the key part. You grow it by reducing its reliance on the owner so that you get the growth, but you also have the personal freedom to enjoy it. Because he and I have both been involved in startups and have seen that culture where people will be putting in, you know, 6-7-day-a-week work, 10-14-hour days, and that becomes a habit. Yet so many business owners get stuck when they reach that second level where the business is sustainable, but they base it all on their personal production. And as a result, they get trapped. The business can't survive without them. It makes it very difficult to ever sell it. And if they do sell it, they're not going to get very much for it. And it makes it hard that after 5 or 10 or 20 years in this, you get burnt out. And so that's why we wrote the book Scale. So talking about this idea of how to systematically get growth but at the same time, get your life back. And we both recognized that in our earlier businesses, we didn't really do it the right way. But in later companies, both of us had found a way that we could actually, you know, have a life at the same time, you know, taking time for family, vacation, and giving opportunity for staff to really grow and assume more responsibility, but protecting the business while doing that by having good systems and sound controls in place.
In your consulting business, Maui Mastermind, do people come to you saying, hey, David, teach me how to scale, or is that what you get them to once you kind of have them in a conversation about something else?
It's a great question, Jim, and I would tell you that usually the person who comes to us is one of two places. The first thing that drives them there is say, David, I have an operating business. It's working. It's profitable. I make a healthy living doing this, but I just feel stuck. I just don't see how I can scale it, and I'm working so hard with it. Or they say, David, this is working. It's growing, but I feel like I have no life. Help. It's wonderful. I might be making $500,000 or $1 million of profit, but I have no life. Help. And so either of those two challenges with that, and what we'll work with them on is how do you, 12, 24, 36, 48 months, how do you put the foundations in place and the actual structure so that you have a pathway, a strategy to grow, and you're executing on that strategy in such a way that you're no longer reliant on the owner? Yes, the owner chooses to be there in many cases, but he or she should have that choice versus the mandatory presence, because the more they're required to be there, you know from this world of spending so much time in M&A, the more dependent the company is on the owner, the harder it is to sell it.
Sure.
The larger it is at the discount you're going to have to take when you sell it. And the more of the price that you get is going to be set up as an earnout or some other string attached to it once you leave the business, if they even let you leave the business when you sold it.
Well, that is so true. And you're right. I do this, help people buy and sell businesses for a living. And when you're talking to selling your company, especially to a financial buyer like private equity, your ability to be able to walk away from that business and it still work without you, it's kind of an oxymoron, but that's when your business is more valuable. But you've got to, it doesn't get there by accident.
Absolutely. And we see this all the time, this sense that a business owner says, well, David, if I don't stay in control of the business, what's going to happen is that things will fall apart. And they think that the more I work, the more I personally produce, whether it means making the key decisions or interacting with the best customers or clients or being involved in the sales process intimately, what they don't recognize is that will, it's like sugar. That will give them a burst of growth.
Yes.
Absolutely it will.
Yes.
But it won't give them something they can sustain. It's not really nutritious calories. It's just empty calories. And so by working less and getting the business to produce more, I'm actually able to sustainably get past that owner-reliant trap. And once you do that, then the world opens. But most small business owners, just no one's ever taught them that that's doable for them. They see examples of the people who've gotten all the way through the other side of it, but that seems so foreign to them. It's that hurdle at the $1 to $20 million stage that we find so interesting. And depending on the business, it might be a little bit more for some of the listeners here who have, you know, a manufacturing business or some other company has a lower margin but higher volume, a little bit different from a service firm where that profit margin might be 20, 30% or more for their operating profit.
Well, you and Jeff have written a book that's more than 200 pages, so I'm not going to ask you to give us all your concepts at once. You know, listeners should buy the book, but are there two or three kind of big ideas that you think as a starting point to grab hold of, to appreciate the principle, to move towards scale?
Absolutely. I'll share three. In addition to this idea that you have to make the decision to build a business versus building a job for yourself. So here's the first one. And the first one is this idea that if you want to execute, one of the concepts that we find so important, and it's in chapter 4 of the book, this idea of creating a one-page strategic action plan that rolls forward every 90 days. Entrepreneurs, you've seen it, Jim, right? We're very much ADD folks.
Yep.
And if we're not careful, we drive our staff crazy because it seems like every day or every week we change the focus or change the playing field.
I thought that was just me.
Well, I tell you, one of the reasons why clients get the success is because their staff can dig in and help them, because now their staff knows that for 90 days, these are the top three strategic priorities for the company, the criteria of success for each, the action steps and milestones, and who owns what by when. So that one-page version, not the 10-page,
Yep. Because
the more detail you put, the less likely you are to use it week in, week out. So that's the first concept.
Are you saying do it for 90 days, then 90 days thereafter do it again?
Exactly. Okay. Every 90 days, another action plan says, okay, for the next 90 days, here's what we're focusing on. And you'll tie it in if you're doing this the right way. And the book talks about this as well, creating a multi-year and a one-year plan. But that's not where people get lost. People are great at creating this multi-year plan, but they have no idea how to execute
yes.
on it. Too lofty, these goals.
Yes.
And this series of rolling 90-day plans that you just put into just one page, not more, one page, you can visually take it in all at once, makes such a dramatic difference to let you focus on those fewer, better things that make a tremendous difference. Because it's not about more, it's about better in the business. And I see that all the time.
Right. Okay, number two.
So number two is going to get back to this idea of systematization of the business. So you've got five functional pillars of your company, right? You've got sales, marketing, operations, HR or team, leadership, executive leadership, and finance. You might call them different things. You might break sales and marketing into two. But functionally, every business has to perform those five functions. And there are predictable obstacles to scaling for each. But one of them is this idea of how and what it means to actually systematize your business. And here's the big idea for it. Most people, when they hear systems, think, oh, policies and procedures manual. And that's so not accurate or correct, because policies and procedures manuals just aren't used. You might invest lots of energies to create a 200-300-page document that spells out the operation for your company, but your team doesn't use it. So the systems we talk about in Scale is specifically systems that are tools that people use on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. And because systems now become used and part of the ongoing, not just an archive of historic how-to or information, but an ongoing, living, breathing thing, the systems stay current. The more current they are, the more likely people are to use, et cetera. So that would be the second big idea. And the book, again, talks about how to do that, how to create the hierarchy of how to store that stuff, how to actually build out the systems, and has all kinds of examples. But the idea is systems have to be things that are used day in, day out, not a historical archive of past data.
Gotcha. Now, what chapter is that? Would that be chapter... I'm looking through the book.
Oh, you want the chapter number two, Jim? No, that'll be chapter number two and chapter number eight,
okay.
Both of those.
Okay.
Two gives you the overview, and eight gives you the nitty-gritty.
Gotcha.
We broke it up that way intentionally.
Cool.
The final one that I think I'll share with your listeners here, because I'm assuming that anyone listening to this podcast, likely your business is working well, or you've had some business successes and you're about to buy another company.
Right.
So you probably are fairly strong on the operational parts of the business. You're probably pretty strong on the sales marketing, both of which are talked about in the book. But the third kind of point failure you see is once someone gets by the needing to sell enough to make the business work, and once someone gets by how to build and really do well with the operational portion of the company to produce their product and service well, the next point failure is the financial pillar. And I'll point out here on the financial pillar, the place I'd want to look at is this idea that this isn't the big idea from the book, but this is the place where I see it just gets messed up in businesses that make this jump, which is on managing cash flow. In the book, we talk about this as the seven cash flow commandments. I don't want to go through each of them, but I'll mention a couple just to be clear on it. So for example, one of the cash flow commandments has to do with collections. You know, one of the biggest reasons that businesses get into trouble is not because they're not selling enough, but because they're not collecting enough of what they sold.
Sure.
So they have all the cost of goods sold, but none of the revenue or a portion of the revenue. And businesses are historically awful at that. So if someone told me, David, my company's having a little bit of a cash flow challenge, the first place I would look to see is how good are they and how timely and quick are they at collection on the receivables. And oftentimes that'll be the biggest one. The next place I'll look, and this would be cash flow commandment number five, has to do with your margins. And so, Jim, I noticed that people are really good at understanding their profit margin. They might call it net profit margin, but really what we're talking about here is your operating profit margin,
right.
Your pre-tax profit. And people get that. Hey, this is what you have left over after you pay all the expenses. But it shocks me the number of business owners, and these are business owners who own companies with sales of $2 million, $20 million, $50 million. I mean, it's surprising, but generally about that $2 to $20 million that still don't really get how important having good financial systems that clearly give them their gross profit margin. Like, for example, I was talking with a woman who owns a very successful professional services company. She's been in business for close to 20 years. She was having some cash flow challenges, and she was asking me some questions about this. I asked her, I said, well, talk to me here about your gross profit margin. She said, what? I said, okay. I said, if you were to pull your P&L, like, for example, in her company, they provided occupational and speech therapy for a lot of clients, they don't call them patients, they call them clients. And I asked her, I said, where do you account for the staff that directly work with clients, your therapists, your occupational and speech therapists? And she said, well, that's down here under my expenses. I said, that's interesting. Because she didn't set up her financial system the right way, that really should be set up as a cost of goods sold.
Right.
So that QuickBooks or whatever, Peachtree or whatever financial accounting system you're using could easily give her a monthly print up or more frequent with her gross profit margin. And the gross profit margin for managing cash flow is critical because what it tells you, the owner, is how are you doing about things like producing your product or service in a cost-effective way, and strategically, how are you doing on pricing? That's the next most common cash flow reason why people have challenges, is they price too low relative to their costs. And so it's not about selling more. The more they sell, the worse they get into this thing here. I even worked with one CPA firm, and here's the irony of it. When we looked at their margin analysis by client, a third of their clients, Jim, were negative margin clients. They were losing money on every single one of these.
Wow.
One-third of their clients.
An accounting firm.
Yeah, and you know, and it's not that unusual that business owners in this kind of small category, 1 to 20 million a year, that they don't really quite understand that all-important gross margin. And that's why I'll point it out here to your listeners that that's a big idea we talk about in scale. That's part of this idea of the seven cash flow commandments. It just makes such a difference.
Well, I see the reality of this every day on both sides. When a company has these components in place and these systems working and good visions for what's coming up in the business, and good,
yeah,
solid financials and understanding of gross margins, those businesses, not only do they sell for more, the process is reasonably easy.
Yeah, and less stressful for that owner. I mean, it's terrifying not to know how you're doing today, next month, next year. You can't predict anything if you don't have that visibility.
Well, listen, I really appreciate your feedback and that perspective, and I would encourage everybody who's listening to buy the book Scale, and we'll have a link to your website in our show notes. And David, if folks want to learn more about your consulting, what's the right way to connect with you?
The easiest way for them to do would be to get onto our website, MauiMastermind.com, M-A-U-I. MasterMind.com. And on there, they should just take a look at one or more of the free resources that are on there. And that'll give you a good feel, or get a copy of Scale. And you'll get a sense for exactly how we approach growing a business. And if that is appropriate, what we'll tend to do with a prospective client is we'll do a complimentary coaching session, a strategic session on their company. Take 90 minutes together with one of our coaches to do a deep dive on what the strengths, weaknesses of the business are, and give our very best suggestions for scaling it. And based on that, if there's a mutual fit, wonderful. And if there's not, then no harm, no foul.
Can folks connect with you long distance? Is this done by phone, or they have to have one of your consultants nearby for direct face-to-face?
Great question, Jim. So the way we work with clients is primarily done by phone. And then once a quarter, we actually fly, all of our clients fly in to get in person or through a live webcast for a strategic planning session, advanced training. And we do that quarter by quarter. But the rest of it's done biweekly by phone, and the other resources are done online and by phone.
Well, I can just say that because I see so many businesses and talk to so many business owners who are thinking about selling, your advice is spot on. You've seen it in practice in your own business, you know, affairs, plus through scores, if not hundreds of clients. So I can't recommend your book enough. And frankly, I frequently have business owners come to me and ask for help, and I'm going to add your book to my pantheon of advice to say, here, read this book, and this will get you started down the road. And that's, I guess I would close in saying that I tell business owners all the time, the best time to sell your business is when you don't have to. And that means don't wait until you're forced to do these things. It'll always have a suboptimal result.
That is great advice, Jim, with that part. Starting well in advance, years in advance of when you actually want to have that sale happen, gives you plenty of time to make the changes, to make the company more valuable and more marketable. I totally agree.
Well, David, I want to again say thanks for your time. Your counsel is invaluable, and I hope our listeners can connect with you by buying the book and or going to your website and getting, you know, directly connected with your consulting services. So let me just say thanks again for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Jim, and thank you for having me.
Well, friends, I hope you have learned something about buying and selling a business in this week's episode of Entrepreneurs M&A Journal. If you enjoyed this program, head on over to iTunes and subscribe, and leave us a review. And remember the words of my hero, Benjamin Franklin, by failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail.
I'll see you next week with another conversation on Entrepreneurs M&A Journal.
Entrepreneurs M&A Journal is a production of the Tennessee Valley Group, Incorporated. Be sure to check us out online if you are interested in buying or selling a business. Go to tnvalleygroup.com. That's tnvalleygroup.com. See you next week.